Stand by. Is this thing on?
Yes, Dan.
Oh, hello.
You're listening to Old News with Dan and Carrie.
This just in.
Breaking news to report.
We are live.
Old newscasters reunite.
Can we just say former?
Sure. Former newscasters reunite behind the mic after more than 20 years.
Old news is good news.
Stay tuned. Welcome to the official first episode of Old News. I am Carrie.
And I'm Dan. And old news is everything and anything, right? We can talk about all kinds of topics in all kinds of places. That's the beauty of a podcast like Old News. And we have a great guest for our very first Old News guest today.
Lisa Fielding is a WBBM anchor and reporter. She is on the radio every weekday from 3 to 6, and we are super excited to talk to her. I do have to warn you that her audio, she was recording from her phone, and the audio kind of gets a little faint sometimes and then louder. So just know that it's not on your end, it's on our end, but you can still hear everything she says, and she is amazing. So let's roll.
3, 2, 1.
Our guest today is anything but old news. Lisa Fielding is an anchor and reporter on WBBM News Radio in Chicago. Lisa's voice fills the airwaves weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 p.m. Dan and I worked with Lisa more than 20 years ago in Madison, Wisconsin. She's had a fascinating career, and we are so grateful to catch up with this award-winning journalist. Lisa Fielding, welcome to Old News. When we first met you, you came to the brand new Fox station.
Yes.
Can you go back in the time machine and tell us how that all evolved in your role at Fox and the relationship of Fox with WKOW at the time?
Okay. Well, I was working in Rockford, Illinois at the time. I was the weekend anchor there back 20 plus years. And I was looking for, you know, bigger and better, moving on up the ladder. And I love Madison. I always had and have and do still. And was just kind of looking for that perfect opportunity. Didn't find it. I was looking for a new job for like a year, as we all do, you know, after our first or second steps, we want to go to the next city. And how did I even find out about this opening? Maybe, oh my gosh, I have to go back totally in the time machine where we were sending out VHS tapes, right?
Right.
And we had to have the internet then, I suppose. I must have
like saw an opening maybe on a job line of some sort. And I think I randomly sent my tapes to Todd Pritchard, who was the news director then, and Sandy Kowal, our assistant news director, brought me in for an interview. Obviously, I just loved him and both of them. Mm-hmm. And it was a new concept. I mean, this startup is such a risk, but WSVN at the time, David Ford was the general manager. They really sold me hard. It was a brand new set. I remember seeing the set. I remember sitting down for like a test run with then my co-anchor or potential co-anchor, Jerome Turman.
Oh, yeah.
Who I think was doing like cut-ins at in Milwaukee at TMJ at the time. Hmm. So I remember I was so nervous. They had all the big wigs. I think it was Bob. Who was the general manager at the time for you guys?
Bob Miller was the general manager,
Bob
I believe.
It was Todd Pritchard, David Ford,
who was the general manager at Fox at the time. And they were telling us they were starting this brand new early newscast. And then it was like the big trend that Fox National News was trying to get local news. And we were going to bring it at 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock. And it was, I remember being so nervous because they were all watching us. And I swear to God, I think Bob brought his family or something crazy.
Oh, no pressure whatsoever, right? But everyone at KOW was so nice.
And I'll tell you something. I remember walking in the lobby of KOW and all your guys' pictures were like up on the ceiling. Do you remember that?
Oh my. Yes. The huge posters.
Yes. And there was like clouds up there. Like it was like
literal cloud mural or something. And I remember looking up going, oh,
this is the place. This is super cool. And
don't you still have your big head from the WKOW lobby?
I never got one because I was Fox, but you guys had them. There, I remember.
Mine was floating around as a white elephant gift for a while. Like we'd pass it on to the next person and then they'd like take it places on vacation. It was a riot.
Those were gigantic pictures. Now that I think about it. You guys were like the news gods looking down at me, like telling me
to come join the family. And I was like, okay.
So that's how it started, I think. And then I remember coming up and, like, you know, doing the fun part. And I mean that sarcastically, you know, negotiating the contract. I didn't have an agent or anything. So I kind of went in like, I don't know, just pay me more than I'm making right now.
Yeah.
And give me a better schedule and see how it goes. And so
I know that we were really an unprecedented pioneering type of project, partnering with WKOW, right? Mm-hmm, and, right. You know, I was the only anchor on the Fox, but then Jerome would also anchor with you guys sometimes. We shared, I think, most of the staff. I think we might have had one reporter, but we got a lot of like national and international press, being one of the very first local Fox stations to start up. And of course, the partnership, like, how is that going to work? You guys are competitors.
How do you do it? And as you guys can recall, you know, we had a
lot of, you know, ups and downs and kind of growing pains, but to my knowledge, I think they're still doing really, really well, like 23 years later now. Yeah. So that was really an amazing, kind of scary, risky, but very fun. One of my best memories professionally of being there in Madison, for sure.
When you remember, as you know, for those of us who were working on the Channel 27 side, the WKOW side, there's a lot of like, what's going to happen? How is this going to work? How are they going to steal our stories? Are they going to know what stories we're working on? But it just kind of flushed itself out. And I think that's a credit to you, because you were also, weren't you the executive producer for the show too?
Yes. I'm a control freak.
I had to have my sticky fingers in it just so I could
editorially like fight for, like, I kind of went into like how, you know, cause everybody wants the story first. Mm-hmm. How are we going to do that? How are we going to get our own stories? Like, but I also was a reporter too. So I was able to do my own pieces too, that only ran on Fox, just like you guys had your pieces that we'd only run on ABC. Right. So we'd have those
meetings. Remember, we had the meetings at like 2 o'clock and we had a
little fighting over some stories, but I think we divvied up pretty well as far as that goes. But we shared a lot of, you know, just like the daily news that we had to report anyways. Mm-hmm. And I think we each had our own kind of enterprising stories too, for sure. Because we had me as reporter, and I think we did have a Fox reporter who was only solely for Fox. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of shared the rest, I think, as I recall. But like, we shared
Mac and we shared Byron. Those were our
media. Byron Morton and Mac was our sports guy.
Mac Charlton.
Yeah, so I was the only, I think, exclusive Fox, but everybody else
we shared, which I think added to your staff as well, I believe, to the ABC side. But I think it worked for many, many years. And then I know that they've since, I think, contracted to another affiliate, right? CBS, I think?
Correct.
Isn't Fox with CBS now? Okay. But,
and you know, it really was a model for kind of the way, in some ways, because of the financial realities of local TV news, it kind of was a model for many stations, not even just Fox, moving into the future from there. So, I mean, you were right on the cutting edge of that. That's true.
You
think back.
We got tons of press for that.
Like more than I think Jerome and I even just like prepared for. I mean, I think like, you know, Inside Broadcast came in and took a bunch of pictures of Todd and me and everybody. And I remember my first producer was named Hope. I forgot her last name. We were on the cover of like RTND magazine or something. It was crazy.
Yeah.
That's wild.
KO was doing so well too, though. You know,
money wise and stuff. Like, there's all these perks, you know, hair and makeup back in the day.
In the lounge, I'm like, hey, sign me up. This is great, you know.
So I had a wonderful time in Madison, and I always tell people, I think I had the most professional freedom and satisfaction there, because I was able to do
some really, really great, fun, and important stories
there. Because Todd and Sandy gave me kind of really the freedom to kind of pick what I wanted to do. And another kind of trend that happened then was, I don't know if they still do it, but we had to really look at our own programming and do stories that tied into programming.
Oh,
and I
at some of the stories that I ended up doing. Do you remember that first
reality show called Joe Millionaire?
Oh yeah. I would have never come up with that, but yeah.
Right when Survivor came out on CBS and everyone didn't know what this reality television was.
Uh-huh. But then after that, Fox debuted this Joe Millionaire. It was about all these women looking for a millionaire, but the guy was really poor in real life.
but he played this millionaire. So it was like the whole game, right? So they said, Lisa, how can we tie in like a story? So a friend of mine runs like a high-end matchmaking company.
Oh, no way.
We did that story and like tied it into Joe
Millionaire. So Fox, and I think the people at Fox who are running over at Madison really knew the power of like tying in your lead-in story with something that people will stick around and watch. Like if they're watching Joe Millionaire, hey, coming up, you know, we're gonna introduce you to a local Joe Millionaire and a high-end matchmaking, and they get people to stick around.
Huh. There was kind of a big method to the madness with the Fox
people, I remember, and how news, I don't know, you know, we're also kind of old school news people and we tend to, you know, cover this day's news, but they really tied into how programming had a big influence on how many people would stick around and watch your newscast after the program. Hmm. So I remember learning all about that too.
Yeah.
Well, and as a side note, it also inspired many, many Hallmark movies.
Yeah. Exactly. I know. There were some crazy shows back,
I guess, in 2000 when Fox was first debuting all that kind of stuff. We had some crazy lead-ins, as I recall.
Hmm. What was your first job and why did you decide to be a journalist?
Okay. Okay, good question. Let's see.
You know, in high school, I used to love writing. And I remember that in my yearbook, I said I was going to be a newscaster. And at my 20-year high school reunion, I got the award of the person who did exactly what they said they were going to do.
Really?
And I thought,
wow, I just got lucky because, you know, you can say you're going to do
something, but doesn't mean you're going to end up being successful at it. But I remember, you know, we had the news on all the time in our house. My mom just had it in the background all the time. And she'd always encourage me, Lisa, you'd be a great journalist. You like to talk, you like to write, blah, blah, blah. And so I went to Bradley University in Peoria, kind of knowing I wanted to do kind of journalism stuff. Yep. I can't say I learned a ton in college. I mean,
did any of us?
No. I mean, now they have amazing programs, but
I had a moment of bravery. I think I was a junior and I literally opened a phone book, kids, one of those things that you open up and turn pages and they're yellow.
And I called like the local NBC station in Peoria
and I said, hey, I'm a journalism student. Do you guys need any interns? I mean, I was super scared to death because I had no idea. I did it on my own.
Huh. Can you start Monday? Because it was summer and they had no
like staff.
Oh,
so
wow.
I got super
lucky. I mean, I had no idea what I was doing.
I literally did not meet. I didn't really learn much. I don't think in the classroom, it was all street. And I had to, they sent me out reporting. Like if it wasn't the first day, it had to have been the second day. I had no idea what I was doing. Huh. I really was,
you know, you learn, you throw to the wolves
and you learn. And so, you know, we were reporting on 3/4 tape and, you know, editing and all that stuff. I learned how to edit in school, but that was my first taste was I worked at WEEK TV in Chicago or in Peoria. Mm-hmm. And luckily it was a small enough market that, you know, they really utilized their students in real life, hands-on way. I wasn't getting coffee or doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was really doing
what everybody was doing. Mm-hmm. So terrible. I had
big bangs and really nasally voice.
I think I still have those tapes somewhere.
But, you know, that's why I am where I am, because I had a moment of bravery and opened that phone book, I'm telling you. And so luckily, you know, you either love it or hate it right away, you know.
Right, right.
I'm not working holidays or weekends, you know, it's making minimum wage.
Yeah.
But luckily I really loved it. And,
wait, you made minimum wage? I didn't even get that much.
Let's see. I think my minimum wage was $3.35 maybe back in
the late 80s. It was. I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, how did we all survive? Like we think
about I don't know.
For the longest time. And so,
you know, I teach graduate class in TV and I say, if you're money motivated, leave right now. Because you get paid back in other ways it's not about money. You know, if you can afford it and you got to go to smaller markets and do it. But, you know, I would say 1 out of 20 of my students maybe stick around for more than 5 years.
Is that right? Oh, wow. Well, and the teaching is on my long list of things to ask you about because you're teaching at Northwestern.
I was for 12 years. I don't do it anymore currently.
Because okay. I finally got a Monday through Friday job after 35 years.
Ah.
Another
you
sacrifice.
Finally made it.
For years, I worked.
Oh wow!
CBM for 12 years on the weekends.
Oh, did you?
Oh my God! I don't know how I did it, but I don't even know what to
do with myself on the weekend now. But yeah, so I taught school when I had Wednesday, Thursdays off. My classes were during the week. But, you know, it's a reality check. You got to be a certain kind of person and make certain sacrifices and be passionate about mm-hmm. what we do as journalists. And not everyone really has that, or the patience, or the, you know, to even go to smaller markets and put your dues in and work the weekends and work the nights and work the holidays.
Right.
And
you know, after the pandemic, it's just not as glamorous anymore.
That's a whole other topic, but we have a tough time getting new recruits anymore.
Nobody is that really right?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I've heard that from a number of people who still work in both television and in radio and in newspaper. It's tough to get people to be journalists.
I know.
Which saddens me.
Glamour and attraction anymore to kids.
Hmm. And that's it's
a shame, because it's really an altruistic kind of job.
Because we're out there trying to help people and inform people, and we just aren't, it's not about money. So I don't know.
What about social media? How does that social media kind of play into that lack of desire to want to be on TV or on the radio?
Well, that's
a good question, because now you've got your citizen journalists, the people, anyone
can take a phone and be a journalist, you know, but as
journalists, we're now expected to be even more multimedia, you know, mm-hmm. like just because I'm in radio,
I'm still doing TV. I'm still using my phone to
capture videos. I'm still like doing, hey, I'm here, blah, blah, blah. You know, tune in, you know, for breaking news. I'm now encouraged to, you probably noticed I'm kind of behind the eight ball on like stories and things on Instagram, but I've been encouraged to like promote my show every day on video. And I'm like,
I don't want to be on TV anymore, but yes.
Stories, Instagram, now TikTok, which I thought I was way too old to be on TikTok. But apparently
now we're all encouraged to do that as well. So
yes, it kind of saturates what are real journalists and who aren't. But on the other hand, if you are a journalist, you're encouraged to do every kind of social media as well. In addition to being a reporter and covering whatever's going on in the street, I'm expected to post to Twitter and, you know, take pictures and do, you know, promotions and things like that before I even get my story on the air.
So that's all part of your daily routine, is now you've got to post to all these different places.
Yeah. And also new journalists
have to learn and know all that, which most of them do now, because that's part of their lives anyway.
Right.
I mean, I think it goes both ways. It opens up a lot of opportunities, I think, mm-hmm. for young people on one hand, because there's all these new forms of news gathering. But on the other hand, you really have to be so versatile to do. We always said when we were younger, we're like, we have to learn how to do everything. But there's so much more everything to do now.
A lot of older people who aren't willing to go into the social media realm.
And you got the old schoolers. I'm kind of in the middle where I can kind of do both. But a lot of my colleagues, you know, are like, they're not doing social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It takes a lot of time if you're not used to doing it, like all the young people are, you know?
Sure. I mean, some of these
influencers start out, you know, really going out all day and posting all day.
Hmm.
I mean, think about that. I mean, for me to even do it every other day is kind of exhausting.
I was going to say, it's exhausting to me to just think of people doing it all day.
Yeah.
I know. I met this one influencer on a press trip
in Vegas about a month ago. He was probably, I don't know, 25. And I have to admit, I was like, oh, who's this little whippersnapper here? What's he doing? And so I said, he had like 100,000 followers or a million. I said, how do you even... And he gets paid to do what he does. He's like, oh, well, I was living with my parents and I decided to go out and take landscapes of Chicago. I'm like, okay, I can do that. but he did it. He
said, I post like 10 times a day and do it every day.
No, it's also circumstance. Like, do you have the
time? Do you have another job that you have to focus on? If
not, are you living with your parents? And the next thing you know, he's making six figures taking landscapes
of Chicago. I don't know. It's it's fascinating to me,
but also kind of frustrating.
Right.
You know,
we all took, you know,
education and dues and small markets and things like that. But there's other pathways now. Yeah.
But like you say good for them, but then the other side of you is like, why can't I do that? You know,
I could.
But I feel like I already have so much to do, and
I feel like I saturate the world too. I'm always like, I have anxiety
attacks sometimes in the middle of the night. Like, am I sharing too much? Oh my God. Are people getting sick of me?
Never, Lisa, never.
Oh,
Let me ask you this, Lisa, because you talked about bravery before when you first started your work. And the joke for a lot of us who used to work in news and are no longer working in news, and we see people like you still doing it, we call you survivors. Hmm. You know, you survived all of these years doing news because it's a tough job. It is a really hard job, and it's gotten harder. How do you keep yourself healthy? How do you keep yourself, you know, mentally and physically healthy to do a job like you do?
Physically, I would say it's the biggest, hardest, because as you guys know, you did morning show for years, and the morning show is almost the most unhealthy schedule if you don't know how to just train your body clock, you know, get into a routine where you get off at 10 a.m., 11 a.m. and work out, keep yourself awake so you can go to bed. Like, I remember even filling in a couple times on the mornings, and it was so difficult. And then you take the opposite where you work 3 to 11, you know, the night shift, which I would say I did the night shift most my entire career. And for me, I'm a night owl. So, but yet I'm not a morning person. So I couldn't get into the routine of like getting up on a normal hour to like work out or eat normal. I'd come home at 10 o'clock and have dinner or be hungry.
Yeah.
You know,
be wired from your job.
This like slob,
you know, where you're just like, I don't say slob, like slug, I should say, because you get tired, you work nights. So you sleep till noon or whatever. And you really have to train yourself to get more of a better body clock. And I have to admit, after all these years, finally having like a Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, I think I'm finally getting into like a more healthy routine where you can do that. So you're very right. I mean, these are not normal hours, you know?
And you really have to have some discipline.
As you get older, of course, when you're young, you have a high metabolism and you can pretty much get by on 4 hours of sleep.
There's no way, you know?
Yeah. And a couple of beers after work, right? Yeah.
Physically, for sure, the mornings are the toughest. I remember you guys
doing that. I mean, I remember I could never even do it past a week. I was like, how do they do this for a lifestyle? It really, I give you guys credit for that. But psychologically, you know, you can go back and think about the things that we see as journalists. You know, they're not always pretty. We see people at their worst. But we try to balance that with good positive stories, making a difference. And I got to say, the pandemic, I never really had an issue psychologically dealing with the things that I've seen over the years. I had a mental health crisis during COVID, and I talk about it a lot.
In addition to everyone else having their own issues.
Yeah.
I never stopped working. I had to go to the office every day.
Oh, really?
I remember thinking, God, should I press the button
on the elevator? Am I going to get cut?
Yeah. We didn't know.
Yeah.
And every day was so stressful because
we were these messengers. Every day was like death. And every day we had the mayor on live. She had a live news conference. And then we'd have the governor. And then we'd have the president, President Trump, going on for 2 and 3 hours of craziness sometimes, where we didn't know whether to keep it going. Are these facts? Are they truth? What is our job in this whole situation? And then in addition, Chicago had all this social unrest, which was almost worse than the pandemic in itself, because George Floyd happened and then people were looting literally around us where we're located on Michigan Avenue. And we had to, you know, at one point they closed down the bridges and they had like the National Guard not letting anyone in one weekend, and we had to have a special letter to get to our workplace. I was also fearful for my family, like my parents. And I thought, well, I'm going to work every day. Can I not see my parents? Am I going to, you know, infect them? Are they going to die? Like, I'm not kidding. I went through so many. Every morning I woke up like thinking I had COVID. I was like, oh my God, taking my temperature. And, you know, I had an oximeter for my lungs. And I guess as a member of the media, you get exposed to so many different things, like literally and figuratively. That whole time was really tough for me. And I thought I was fine. When things kind of opened up again, the fall, I remember like the restaurants started opening. I was like, oh, I got through it. And I felt like I was overcommitted anyways. And I was kind of glad that everything kind of got canceled. And I was like, just like hanging out and not doing anything. But then come October, I started getting these panic attacks.
Oh.
I thought it was having a heart attack. I was like, what is going on? I mean,
I'm fine. What's happening? And so it turns out I was having a little like PTSD where like, you think about the things that bring you joy in your life, you know, travel and friends and being able to go out, and we weren't able to do any of that stuff. And your serotonin wasn't going to your brain. And so I was put on like really low, like Prozac, but it helped. It took it away. But I learned more about how your body reacts to stress, fear, not your life being upended and things that bring you joy. Mm-hmm. And chemically, I had a really like post-traumatic, you know, it was months after the height of the pandemic. So you go through your adrenaline kicks in and you go through what you need to do. But I wasn't feeling the effects until way later. It was so.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So yeah, that was the first time that I had like a psychological
reaction to my career, you know?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you were in the thick of it every single day and there were so many unknowns.
Okay, as anchors,
we read like a lot of bad news, right? And people ask us, are you ever affected by what you see and what you read? And I don't know what you guys think, but I remember everything's kind of compartmentalized. We do our job, we go home, we try not to think about, you know, that horrible house fire that killed six kids or whatever. I don't know, but this one took a toll on me in a totally different way. I guess because it affected all of us. It wasn't just somebody in a neighborhood we never knew. You know,
it was pervasive. You're right. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And everyone had their own kind of mental health journey through it. But
it was the first time that I psychologically, I think, had an outcome from it. So anyway.
What is your stress management strategy now?
Getting
back to normal. And going to events and seeing friends, and I'm a big traveler. I mean, all of that helped me, I think, get my chemicals back to where they were supposed to be. And so I was off the medication after about 18 months. But I talked to a lot of people, and a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I'm on it too, you know? But it does
balance your chemicals.
And I learned so much about that. You can think you're okay, but your body knows you're not. And how you deal with
stress, you know? Now, you know, things are
better for me because I got a more, you know, stable workplace. And after 35 years, I think I've finally figured out a work-life balance, you know,
congratulations. You deserve that after 3 decades.
I know, right? Like I have,
you're the one.
So I can even like make plans with people who are actually
off the same time I am. And
yeah,
just
things like that. Silly things that I don't think like regular
9-to-5 people don't realize how to, you know, and there's tons of people who work weekends and holidays and cops and nurses, and there's so many other things saving lives every day. And I certainly was not on the front lines of that kind of thing. But it was a whole different thing that I learned so much about, just taking care of yourself more mentally than you ever even thought you had to before.
But do you identify with those kind of people? Like, you know, the cops, the nurses, the firefighters. I mean, back in the day when I worked in the news business, I always felt some type of camaraderie with people who worked as firefighters and police officers, not only because you relied on them oftentimes for source material, but they kind of lived a similar lifestyle in many ways. And is it still that way sometimes, or am I stretching here?
Well, I think so
too. It depends on, you know, what kind of city you're in too, and what kind of relationships you have with your first responders as well.
Yeah, Madison,
you
know, Madison's pretty friendly.
Oh, they were great. I remember doing like
media training with them, with cops, on how they can better know that the journalists are your friends and we're here to help you catch the bad guys. Oh. But in many
big cities, you know.
Oh, the media, get them out.
Right.
So it all depends.
But I think, Dan, you're right.
We do. We all work 24 hours. It's not anything that stops. and I mean, they see people at their worst all the time. Yeah. We certainly can balance that a little bit. But psychologically, you know, I believe that more of the cops are setting up mental health programs. I think people are more aware of the kinds of industries that need that help more than others. Mm-hmm. And I think journalists are often forgotten. As far as what we need, we see bad stuff too, just like cops and nurses, and that we're not saving any lives like they are, but we do sometimes arrive at the scene before a cop does or something and see some bad stuff. And how do you deal with that mentally? And I think more companies are realizing that too.
Well, and you've been targeted in the last, I mean, it seems to me you've become a target of people's, you know, slings and arrows over the last 10 years too.
Oh my God, for sure, you know.
I was talking about the pandemic, then the social unrest, and then the election. It was like this like triple whammy of really big, stressful events that had a big deal on the media. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you how many times I walked down the street and I heard fake news. And then we see people that have signs that say murder the media. I mean, that started under a certain administration. But There are people, I hope that that has eased a little bit, but guess what? We're entering another presidential election involving the same kind of person next year. So I have to admit that took a toll on me as well a little bit, but I laugh it off because we're the most objective news source you can find, you know, in the whole state. So when people yell fake news, I go, you don't even know who you're talking to right now. And I have to admit, social media got really, really nasty.
Yeah.
As you
guys can remember in 2020. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And had to block a few people. I felt like I couldn't even post a factual article about anything election related. I mean, mm-hmm. I wasn't even taking any type of side. I was posting, I think it was something about Hillary Clinton being the first woman nominated to the presidency, you know, the nominate as a Democratic nominee. And I posted an article about that that I did, talking to some local women's leaders, and it was about women's issues. Oh, well, you can imagine that started a whole S shit storm. Yeah. And I couldn't.
I'm like, I'm a journalist. I did a story about it.
This is about women, pioneering women, and people just went nutso, you know? So yeah. We experienced
a lot of that where I had to kind of like
block and even defriend some people because they didn't respect that I thought being objective and just posting factual stories. And right. People couldn't see
what are the forest through the trees about what the article was about.
It wasn't about Hillary. It was about a woman, you know, shattering the glass ceiling. And so I'm worried that that's going to happen again next year, because you're right. The media really we had a firestorm, not so much locally as they do nationally, but people don't educate themselves enough
before they make
threats and say dumb things. So well, it was tough.
It's so easy on social media to just be so quick and so reactive. There's no between time anymore. It's just instantaneous. Yeah. Everything's just react, you know, and hiding behind screens.
Social media and election. So we had a triple
perfect storm that was really tough. Mm-hmm. Things calmed down in 2021, but you know, it'll be coming back, I'm sure, next year. So it's all on how we all handle it. We'll see how Americans handle this. I hope that they are a little bit better this time around. We're still very divisive, so that's not going to change.
Right.
But all we can be is objective.
Yes.
Keep our fingers crossed for you.
Yes. Well, a positive thing that you were putting out into the world was your podcast. Was that born out of the pandemic?
Yes, it was.
Great. So when theaters started coming back to life, that's when you started it?
Yes. Well, I grew up an arts and theater kid for sure.
My family took me, you know, all the time when I was young. And it was kind of our thing as a family to go see shows and things like that. So it was always something that I loved. And there wasn't much, you know, with TV news and even radio news, the first thing to cut is like an entertainment reporter. It was not something that a lot of industry was willing to put money into. So I kind of sort of my own kind of niche and kind of went there every once in a while and pitched stories like, hey, I've got this great idea about arts and culture and theater, blah, blah, blah. And they'd let me do this and there. And in addition to my general assignment reporting, but then I started getting to know some of the actors and the customers and the stage managers. And I realized what an economic engine arts and culture was to every city, but Chicago, especially, we have a theater district.
And it was like every city, but this one, just like
New York, dark. For 18 months.
Yeah.
And you
think about the domino effect of that,
of all the people that are employed. And it's a huge economic engine to tourism in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And they had to fight on Capitol Hill to get, you know, money, government money, help. And they just weren't thought of when it came to, you know, COVID relief. And so I started talking to this guy named Joe Shanahan. He owns the Metro here in Chicago, one of them. Like a beloved, famous venue that, you know, he gave REM their first start and The Cure and
you know, Nirvana and just Smashing Pumpkins, blah, blah, blah. So he
said
a couple of little bands.
Yeah,
exactly. And so he's a famous guy
here in Chicago. Actually, he's a famous guy around the world as far as music venues. But he started telling me, like, we are not going to survive even when this pandemic is over. We need to fight and talk to the government and get some kind of money for us. And it took him months to get that COVID relief toward arts and culture and to make, I think, the federal government realize what an impact it has on the economy in general. So when I started talking to all these people, I thought, man, you know, we take arts and culture for granted. you know, like, mm-hmm. oh, hey, let's go to a show next week or whatever. But when you don't have it for 18 months, not only is it the economic part, but it's also psychological. Like, people need arts and culture in their lives, you know? And so I kind of started reaching out that way, and I called it Backstage Chicago, and I started focusing on the people behind the scenes, mm-hmm. in addition to the
actors and people that we do see. And how many things
that are particularly in Chicago, there's probably 250 small and large storefront theaters everywhere.
Wow, that's a lot.
I know about 20,
huh.
But I couldn't believe all the little, you know, the Windy
City Playhouse and like community yeah. theater and everything that goes on everywhere, and how important it really was to so many people. And I mean, I had people coming out of the woodwork wanting to be a part of it. Mm. And, you know, I learned so much about it. And I don't know, I just had a new appreciation to what arts and culture means to all of us as humans.
Oh, yeah.
Let alone
economically. And so
I remember back when you were starting that, actually, because I get posts from you on Facebook and things like that. And I'd see like, oh, she's doing a story on, I think you did one on like the Comedy Expo.
Yes.
That was, and I think they were just kind of getting going again. And there was like an a cappella group that you did one on.
Yes, yes.
And I just found those really fascinating. Not only because they're, you know, cool organizations and neat people who are doing them, but also because, like you talked about before, it kind of gave us hope again that, hey, things yeah. are getting going again.
Yeah.
You know, people are starting to perform again and do things. And like yeah. you said, I mean, hell, how many of us binged about a million shows on Netflix during the pandemic?
Right. It's all we had.
And that yeah. just goes to show how hungry we were for yeah. for stuff like that.
Very
and
true.
I think, you know, podcasts like yours gave us hope. And also, you know, they're fun to listen to.
Yeah. And you find out and you think, who knew there was a LARPing science fiction theater? I mean,
literally, that's how like niche it gets.
Yeah.
Oh, and so it's a theater designed for
science fiction. And they do LARPing and real life action, like, you know, what's the Bristol Renaissance, that kind of stuff, you know,
yep.
those kind of groups. We have a Star Wars club. Who knew? We have a Ghostbusters club in Chicago.
I mean, these are the funny things that you realize. So many hobbies and
things.
Yeah.
Most
storefronts and clubs made it through the pandemic, but there are plenty that
did not and had to close down for good. And so that's a whole other, you know, issue. But they're still having some trouble getting people back.
Hmm.
You know, Steppenwolf just had to make a bunch of cuts.
Oh.
So hopefully people will come back. I mean, my world has gone back
like yeah. tenfold. But there are a lot of people who still don't come to the city, maybe because they think the crime and, you know, there's a lot of things that people that prevent people from going downtown and things like that. But it's still an amazing experience in any city, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I hope that we've given voice to small groups and things that people might not have known about and said, oh my God, I love science fiction. I should go see that little, you know, theater on Halsted or whatever, you know? So that's what I had hoped to do. I wanted to get really unusual things. I did a whole, I think, 45 minutes on burlesque.
I saw that. I've got to listen to that one as I was scrolling down the topics. Like burlesque.
Huge thing in Chicago. Huh. It's also very
it's about body positivity for women as well.
Yeah. Burlesque is huge up here in Madison too.
Is it?
Yeah.
So yeah. we did something on that. So those are the things I kind of look for, you know, unusual things. Because people mm-hmm. know about the Hamiltons and the, you know, big stories. But people don't know about the smaller kind of things that are going around, mm-hmm. you know, cabaret. And like you said, a cappella, which is amazing, too. Yeah. Just things that people not only need to see, but also participate in. All these talented people, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and so you're a lover of the arts. You're a supporter of the arts. You're also big into baseball.
Oh.
And you've had baseball related jobs. Can you tell us about your sports background?
Okay.
Go Cubs.
Yeah.
A little team called the Cubs.
Brewers too. So.
Let's see. Well, I grew up, I tell about a funny story because I grew up in Chicago, northwest suburbs, but my dad grew up on the south side of Chicago, and he was something called an Andy Frayne usher. It was an usher company that used to, you know, just be the ushers at the old Comiskey Park, but they'd also go to the old Chicago Stadium and they give the programs and they were the vendors, right?
Oh, fun.
So he grew up on the south side, and I grew up going to see Sox games, like you know, Pudge and like, you know, Harold Baines and all those guys. Those are all Southsiders in the '80s. So when I went to college, my great grandfather had season tickets to the Cubs, which I unfortunately never got to experience, but I remember always watching the Cubs games with my great grandfather, but was forced to go to the South Side with my dad and my brother. So when I went to college, there was a minor league team called the Peoria Chiefs. And I love minor league baseball. Like that's like, I love that. And so I started going to the Chiefs games and I realized they were affiliated with the Cubs. I'm like, aha. So now I can watch the Cubs without my dad getting mad at me because I'm at college. He won't know I'm going to these games.
So I ended up getting, going there and being
interested in that. And got to know a lot of the front office and the players of the early, like late 80s. I would say like Mark Grace and like Ty Griffin used to be in the Olympics and Joe Girardi. I could name a bunch of people that were down in the minor leagues and how that works. Like there's these farm system, A, you know, single A, double A, triple A, and probably one out of 50 might make it to the big show, as you might remember from Bull Durham. It was such a romantic kind of thing where all these kids would come and make $20 meal money just for hopes to be in baseball. Wow. Right. And so I thought, God, these kids have big dreams, just like young journalists, you know?
Yeah, really.
Most of them don't ever make it, you know? And so anyway,
when I moved to Rockford, Illinois, there was another minor league team there at the time. It was affiliated with the Montreal Expos, the former Montreal Expos. And so I thought, God, I love minor league teams. Let's go see. And they needed a public address announcer. So I decided to try out for the public address announcer. Well, I had moved from TV to radio at that time. So I got the job and it turned out to be like this fun, like thing that I did after I would work. I don't even know. But I would work, I think during the day, it must've been as a reporter at the radio station or the TV station. And then I'd go and do the games at night. And I think I might've made $20 a game or something, but they were the most fun times because, you know, we'd have wacky mascot races and like Max Pacton was there. He was in Bull Durham and Kurt Russell would come and watch his nephew, Matt Franco, who was like in the single A. And so I got to know that world a lot. And so I fell in love with baseball even more. I used to love it as a kid, but seeing how these kids, you know, would start out in the single A and just work their way up was such a, I don't know, fascinating and rewarding and kind of romantic way of this game, of seeing how what it's really like. And so obviously I was affiliated with Cubs after that. It was Montreal Expos and then it was the Rockford Royals. And then we were a player development contract with the Cubs. So Randy Hundley would come out and all these Cubs guys would come visit, Brian Sandberg. And so I was like, oh man, this is so fun. So obviously I would go to Cubs games as much as I could at that time.
Right.
And even when I lived in Wisconsin, you know, I'd come back for the games and that infamous 2003 Steve Bartman game. Ay, ay, ay. And then I was in Milwaukee at that time. And, you know, all my Wisconsin friends were like, oh, Steve Bartman, blah, blah, blah. So we've had a lot of trials and tribulations as Cub fans. But then when I finally moved to Chicago, I mean, my dream came true when I was able to cover the Cubs in the World Series in 2016. It was almost crazy that it took 104 years or whatever, but my whole life too. But people are older than me that waited longer than that. So I just love, I don't know, just the whole sport of baseball and the whole farm team and the dream. So I don't know, it sounds kind of cheesy, but
I think it's really cool.
I think we were all Cubs fans that year, really, unless you were, you know, a fan of, I can't, who did they play in the series? I'm trying to remember. Was it?
Cleveland.
I mean, unless you're a Cleveland fan, I mean, who wasn't pulling for the Cubs?
I know. Really? I know. I love that. Yeah. I think my dad won't admit it. He won't even walk into Wrigley Field.
He won't walk into Wrigley Field even when they're playing the Sox.
Really?
Wow. I mean, we have a good bond. Like little rivalry every year.
Yeah, but he will not even go step into Wrigley Field. So he's a diehard. But Dan, you're right. Most of the world was pulling for the Cubs for sure.
Did you ever think about being like a public address announcer for like the Cubs or a big league team?
I did try out in, let's see, what year was it?
Wayne Mesmer is the national anthem singer now, but he used to be the public address announcer and he had a tragedy when he was working for the Chicago Wolves. He got shot in the neck.
Which is so bizarre for a guy who relies on his
gosh,
he probably recovered, but when this happened
to him, he obviously had to leave his job at the Cubs, so they put a national search out. I did make the finals, however, you really couldn't have a full-time job at the time. Yeah. You had to make that your full-time job.
Pardon me. I had to sneeze. Thank you.
I'm not sure if I would have.
There's nowhere to go.
Yeah, I know, right? I had a job, but I was in the finals, but I couldn't. I knew that I
couldn't do it realistically because I think they hired some really, he was a talented guy, but he like worked at Barnes and Noble or something. So he had more of a flexible job. I had a full-time radio job at the time. So I don't know. Yeah. I look back and think, oh, should I have, you know, you never know. But I was the first female public address announcer in baseball in 1991.
Really?
Ever.
Oh
my gosh. That's amazing.
Now they should have
more 35 mm-hmm. years later, but they do have, like, Boston has one, San Francisco had one, and there's a few minor league women. Fox Sports called me maybe 5-6 years ago asking me about this girl who got the job in Beloit, and really? I said, why is this news 25 years ago? Why is it still news? Yeah. This should be mainstream. You know,
right?
But yeah, I mean, we're still trying
to shatter that glass ceiling with the public address announcing and women. Not a lot of women go for it, I guess, maybe. And they should. So anyway.
So I asked you about your first job. I'm gonna be the first, worst, and thirst job guy. Okay.
Oh,
so
okay.
So your best job.
Okay.
You know, I'm gonna just say your best job is the job you have right now. Okay. But
Okay.
what was your worst job, and what is the job that you might still thirst for?
Okay. You mean worst job, not in this business ever?
No, just your worst job. Yeah.
When I was 14,
I probably wasn't even legal to be working, but I was working in this park district, and it was like a park district where corporations would, it was a like a park, and it had like rides and all this stuff. And I don't know why they made me be the cook. Cause I mean, I had to grill like all this
chicken and burgers. And my mom left because
I swear I gave everyone food poisoning because I didn't even know how to cook. I don't know what I was doing.
At 14.
I was 14 and they were having me cook all the burgers for like
the Kemper Insurance picnic.
Oh my gosh.
I remember my eyes were burning so hard. And like, I swear the guy who ran this park is probably.
There was probably 5 million violations with minors working for him and like me cooking in front of like an open flame without eye protection. And we had to clean the bathroom.
Oh gosh.
So yeah, I hated that job. And then we had to open the concession
stand after it was closed all winter and it was just nasty. So yeah, I just did not like that job at all.
No.
And how about a job you're still thirsting for if there is one?
Wow.
You know, people always ask me, what would you do if you weren't a journalist? I love photography. You probably can guess that from my posts. I mean, I travel, I think, because I love taking pictures and, you know, that kind of thing. So I would love to be I wish I was in on the whole like travel influencer trend before anybody else. Obviously there's 5 billion of them now, but I think I could have done something with that. I didn't even know. And a travel photographer, I think, would be a great job. I think working in sports and baseball still was something I've always wanted to do. I don't know. Yeah. I think those
two.
Did you
ever do a book or anything like that with your photos? Did you ever do a book or
something? I did, actually. Let's see.
I read about that. I was going to ask you. I know. I was waiting to ask.
Here it is.
Just so happened to have it.
Sitting next to the coffee
table. That's beautiful.
Coffee table book.
What is it called? Wait, what is it called? Drinks?
It's called Drinks with a View.
And when I first, when Facebook first started coming out, was that 2008 or something? When I would travel, I would order these like fancy drinks and then I would take a picture of them and everyone's like, oh, what are you, alcoholic, Lisa? I'm like, no, there's a method to the madness. So I culminated all these pictures, but I always had to have like, you know, a background of something beautiful, right? Yeah. So I have from Amsterdam and Greece and like, even I think there was one in Madison and one in Rockford next to the river or the lake, Lake Winona or whatever, you know? So I try to do that. I did it domestically and internationally and it would say travel photo coffee table book.
That's so
and
cool.
So it was just something I wanted to put together and display. I did it through Blurb, which is something anyone can do. Yeah. And people can buy it if they want to. I had a few people buy it, but that really wasn't why I did it. But I should really do a volume 2 because this one's 10 years old already. And I've luckily been to a lot more places since then, but it was travel's my passion. My nephew always jokes because I call myself a sunset chaser, because everywhere I go, I'm obsessed with sunsets. So if I travel somewhere, I look up best place to see the sunset. So that'd be something else I would do if that was an actual job.
Yeah. Well, just keep publishing those books. Where has your favorite drink and sunset occurred?
What a great question. What do you think?
Oh my gosh. Well, anywhere in Greece, yeah. I mean, sunsets are a ritual. It's like part of the culture. So every night I would pick a new place where we would see it. And there was, you know, they play Andrea Bocelli and it was like this emotional thing. It was like crazy. And so where else? Well, Key West has an amazing sunset as well.
I'll be there soon. Yes.
I'm just there.
Oh, I went bragger.
Well, I went there too. I'm a huge
Jimmy Buffett fan. Mm-hmm. So when he died, I was like, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but Parrotheads took it very seriously, like very, you know. So he started his career there. So we did a little Jimmy Buffett memorial tribute and I got a tattoo there. And it's in Key West of a parrot. So
that's awesome.
But if you go, you got to go to the sunset.
That's their probably second to Santorini and Greece.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I've been to Santorini, and next week we're actually going to Key Largo and Key West because my daughter's getting married in Key Largo.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. You have a daughter old enough to be married.
That's crazy.
I know.
Well, how about that, huh?
Yeah.
I know. Where is she getting in Key West? Anywhere specific?
We're going to Key West after the wedding, so we're doing the actual wedding in Key Largo since it's closer to Miami, a little friendlier to the, it's a small destination wedding, but still the number of people coming, we were like, we don't want them to drive that far for
US is so fun, and it's small enough to just walk everywhere and I do bed. But yeah, go to sunset to Mallory Square for sunset. So
I'm gonna write that down. Mallory Square.
We're getting travel advice from you.
I know. See,
we're just talking. My wife and I were just talking about going to Greece someday. That's like on our list. We want to go to
Greece. I've been there twice. So. And so, maybe need anything.
I did my yoga training there.
Cool. I'll zoom you up.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I'd go back in a second. The weird part is, I went there, I had two weddings within 10 years. It was so weird.
Yeah. Wow. I'm like, hey, I'm there. So.
Oh, yeah. It's so
I'll go back in a second. Beautiful place. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, we should probably let Lisa get back to her life here.
Oh, no, that's quickly. Okay. This has been so fun. I feel like I want to ask you guys questions.
That can be part two.
I have one more question for you, though, unless you have many more, Carrie. I'm sure you have many, many more on your list than I do. But my question, like, who are your mentors? Who are the people you look up to, keep you going?
I have to admit, I don't know. We're all kind of the same age. I don't know. I mean, we all kind of had, I felt like I had to kind of fend for myself. I'm the oldest of my family, first to go to college. And I just like, I kind of had to wing it to some degree. I wish I had a me in my life back then, someone that could say, don't go to the station, look at this contract. This is how you do, look for this, make sure they have good equipment. Like, I didn't know what to, I mean, I fared fine, but I really kind of went into this career really blind, for sure. I mean, I love Diane Sawyer. I love Deborah Norville. I remember watching, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't have any local mentors growing up. Yeah. But I hope to be that to many people now, I worked with a woman who was my mentor at WBBM for many years. Her name is Chris Kreidel, and she was an institution in Chicago. Everyone knew her as like the woman on the radio. She was so smart, whip smart. She retired probably 4 or 5 years ago, but I would say she was my local mentor at WBBM for sure. But going through the trenches like we all did, I wish I had someone to kind of guide me into, I don't know, what to look for. When you negotiate a contract or like
when you find a city to go to, is it an O&O? No,
an operated situation. Do you have, paths to growth and things like that? And you learn kind of after the fact of things as a kid, as a young journalist, what you probably should have known or to have been look out for. So I try to do that for new journalists now, so they make the right decisions and get paid enough to make a living and all that stuff.
Well, and at the level you are now, do you have an agent, or how does that work? Do you still do it yourself?
I had one from NTB, from
Madison to Milwaukee. BBM didn't really talk to agents. So we're a union now. We're at SAG-AFTRA. So that helps. So I don't need an agent anymore. I plan on finishing my career here. It's where my family is. I have no network aspirations or anything like that. I tell my students, don't get an agent until you absolutely have to, because you can get your own jobs and not pay the 9% and get killed, you know? And if you get in the larger markets and you need to negotiate high figures, things like that, then yes, you can do that. And some stations don't even talk to you without an agent. So I had a bad experience with mine. He will remain nameless. And
I am very not fans of them. Unless you
absolutely find a good, honest one who's going to do your best and make you a priority. Because I was with an agency or someone who had 5 million other, you know, leases. So I really, you know, they didn't really care about what I was doing and just took the 9% anyway. And I ended up getting my own job from Madison to Milwaukee. David Ford, who was the Fox general manager, went to Milwaukee and he took me with him. That's why I left.
What year did you leave KOW?
2003.
I was there 1999 through 2003.
Okay.
And went to Milwaukee from 2003 to 2006. And I got that job on my own through David, and my agent took the money anyway.
Really?
You live and learn, right? And the fine print said, even if you get your own job,
you still owe us 9%. Well, I thought to myself, I'm not going to get my own job. This guy's going to do it for me. Like, why would I get my own job if I have an agent? But it just so happened that it was more of like a promotion within the company. And he took the money anyways. So I had to get a lawyer to get him to cancel that contract. So, you know, young kids just need to know their rights and what they need and don't need to do right away and young in their career, you know? So,
it's good to hear you say that you want to guide people down, you know, moving their way down the road, because it is hard. You are kind of on your own, and it is a very tough business. I'm sure it's gotten even tougher since Carrie and I were doing it on a daily basis. So it's good to have people like you out there, I think. So thank you for doing that for people. Yeah, that's awesome.
Tax time. Think about
back when we had clothing allowances and things like that. Those are all things that you could write off back then, you know, like a magazine subscription, a cable television, because I'm doing research as a reporter. Like, all those things really would have helped, I think. I think there needs to be like a class for young journalists about things, finances, contracts, you know, ethics, just things that I don't think any of us really were told about going in.
True.
And to keep and to try to stay financially healthy. My
God. I mean, I lived on credit cards my entire life practically because we just, again, we don't get paid a ton of money. We do it for other reasons, but you still gotta have a life. And I mean,
Madison isn't cheap. I remember my rent was probably
$1,000 or something. I think right back then.
People would love to hear that now.
I know. Well, 20 years ago,
I came from Rockford, Illinois, which was like dirt cheap. You know, $500 tops. And I doubled my rent going to Madison, but I didn't double my salary.
Yeah,
just excited and said, "Hey, I love this."
Road where I worked. I loved my apartment there. And I was like, I'll work out the details later. But you don't realize how financially in trouble you can get, you know, by just taking the job and doing what you want to do at the time. But no one gives you any advisement on how to, I don't know, be a reporter making less money than the cost of living to some degree.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree? I mean, I think all journalists get paid nothing at the beginning.
Right.
Oh, it was tough. Yeah. And and there was people who made even less than the on-air people who are working in the news business. So
Right.
It was tough. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. You really have to learn the sacrifices and how to really manage all that, because you'll pay for it later on in your life, know? So anyway.
Yep. Well, now you've made it to the top, being in the top market. I mean, you must pinch yourself that you're doing this in your hometown.
Yeah. I mean,
it was weird because I had been in television for 15 years and I didn't think of ever going back to radio. My students say, "Lisa, why'd you go to TV to radio?" And I said, "Well, number one, the opportunity came about. BBM was a vault. No one ever left, you know, it's a union job. You never get fired. People are there till they're 80. But there just happened to be an opening, and I had a friend in production and said, come in and see, you know, and I really got lucky with that opportunity. But I also carry, as a woman to woman, you know, women unfortunately have expiration dates in television to some degree. I mean, men can be on the air till they're 80, but women, other than maybe Barbara Walters, they're really, so I had to think about what can I do for the rest of my life and not worry about being skinny enough, young enough, you know, it's true. Wearing the right clothes or whatever. And I got out right before social media, which I'm so glad because I have a thin skin. I admit it. I don't, women specifically get a lot of criticism on social media. Who's on TV? It's just the truth. It's just the truth.
Right. So Carrie and I talked about, we've talked about that before where we were kind of lucky. We got out of the TV business before social media got crazy too.
Me too.
I can't even imagine what people have to put up with.
I know. It's so true. So as long as my voice hangs in there, you know, I'm okay. So I need to ensure my voice or something like.
Yeah.
So I don't have to worry about it. You know, I can roll out of bed and go to work.
It's not a big deal. We don't have to worry about hair and makeup as much anymore.
Because do you ever have cameras on you that you're on YouTube or something? Never.
Never.
You know, it's funny. It's something that my company, I think, wants to do. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people in the union have been resistant to that, but we're behind the eight ball. Like our sister station, The Score, they have cameras. They're on Twitch. They're on everything. Mm-hmm. And they're just dudes doing sports, you know, not necessarily TV people. So we should probably evolve into that at some time, but I'm not in any hurry. I don't need cameras on me while I'm talking on the radio. However, I have done Facebook Lives and stuff while we're doing it, but at least we make that choice to do that.
Right.
So I can kind of control the narrative as far as how many times I put my mug out there, you know, with Facebook Lives or promoting something, you know. But other than that, we're not expected to have cameras. I was saying cameras in the courtroom. No, cameras in the newsroom.
In the studio. My TV days are over.
Well, as somebody who, you know, we all kind of went through all these trends when we worked in television and in radio, I'm sure there's trends too that happen. And, you know, I remember back in the TV days when Carrie and I, back in the old news days, you know, everything had to be live, right? You had to go live. And I'm sure there's still that element of wanting to do certain things in television news. But I often wonder that even with, you know, you talk about The Score, and I listen to a lot of sports talk radio, and I see the back, you know, I watch on YouTube and stuff like that. And I think to myself, how long is this going to be a thing? Like, how long am I going to want to sit there and watch this former sports guy and that former football guy wearing their pajamas talking on the radio? Because you know? At some point it just gets to be like, okay, whatever, like put a suit on or whatever, you know, it'll change. It will change at some point.
You're right.
Yeah.
I know. We didn't enter that. We all laugh because we're like, we're all on radio for a reason. We don't need any cameras in here.
Yeah, that is a nice benefit.
I know. So,
well, I enjoyed listening to you on Odyssey or radio.com Odyssey. And so I was listening to you right here in Pittsburgh all afternoon. And I was like, right away, I picked out I'm like, that's Lisa. That's her. Yes.
Oh, that's so awesome. I love that people can listen from
around the country and the world. That's now, for sure. Cool. And I think it's a huge influence. I mean, when you can put the link and say, click here, because people just aren't in the car anymore really as much. Mm-hmm. And who has radios in their house? Not many people. So you're going to stream it. And so I think that's
the future for sure. We still obviously
are on the radio band for now.
Right.
But I love that I can just put that out there for whoever wants to listen or if anybody wants to click my story. So obviously that's a huge difference for us in the last, I would say, 5 years, is to have that capability and, you know, expand our reach around the world. So that's been good. And I'm glad that, you know, you guys can hear us as well. I mean,
really enjoyed it.
Good.
Well, hey, Lisa, thanks a lot for taking a lot of time to talk with
us. Oh my God.
Thank you so much.
After a full day of work. Yeah, then you come and sit down and talk more news with us.
Awesome. It was great. You know, I had a really good
experience in Madison. Like I always say, professionally, I had the most freedom. I had the most fun. You guys were the most welcoming crew, I swear, under the weirdest circumstances too, you know? And so I really had a great experience there. And I loved living in Madison when you guys were there. So
to see you. Thank you so much. This has been an absolute joy.
I can't wait.
Thanks a ton, Lisa. We'll see you again soon. Okay. Maybe we'll see you at a Cubs game.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You better call me if you come to Chicago.
Will do. Okay. Will do. It's a deal.
Promise.
Thanks for tuning in to Old News with Dan and Carrie.
That's old news for now.
Join us next time.